Hello, I'm Jane Dacre, and I'm pleased to be celebrating International Women's Day with another season of my podcast series, Medical Women Talking. Listen and be inspired by these fantastic women who are all contributing to our futures.
I'm talking to Professor Leslie Regan. So Leslie has recently become the Women's Health Ambassador, and we're going to talk about that. But first of all, Leslie, welcome. And let's start by talking about your career so far.
Oh, thank you, Jane.
Thank you. Thank you for joining me. So first of all, when did you decide you were going to become a doctor?
Well, the story goes, it was my seventh birthday and I announced to my dad that I was going to become a doctor. I have no idea why, because there was nobody in healthcare in our family at all. But several people have asked me this question, and in retrospect, I think it was probably because I had the most appalling hay fever when I was a little girl, and I was part of an experiment to desensitise people and go for weekly injections, and I think I really liked our GP. I remember he was very, very kind to me, not just with the injections and things, but he was just very kind, and when I told him I wanted to be a doctor, he didn't say, oh, that's ridiculous because you won't be able to or anything like that. He was always very encouraging, so perhaps it was that. But I remember him, and he smoked a pipe, and he had this lovely surgery, and it was always warm and cozy in there, and I just thought he was a very nice man. And I remember also, every time I left his surgery, I felt better. I don't know why, because it never really desensitised me, all these weekly injections, but I always feel better from having seen him.
A lovely bedside manner, perhaps, a good old-fashioned avuncular bedside manner. Yeah. Okay, so you went through school with that in mind?
Yeah, I went through school with that in mind. That was tricky because I was an absolute dunce at physics and chemistry. The biology was easy, but I was a linguist. I was a really good linguist. Of course, you know, speaking, quite good Russian. In fact, I learned Russian as a young kid. So I've always found languages easy because I learned a different alphabet by the age of 8. But physics was a complete mystery to me. I still remember going to the physics A level, and I tried to do it twice, and opening the paper and thinking, I don't know what they're asking me. It was a complete mystery. So I failed to get into medical school the first time, and I went. I got very cross with everybody, and I went hitchhiking around the Middle East, which was a sort of crazy thing you do when you're 18 and cross. And then I pulled myself together and I came back. And then things started going right, because I booked myself into Kingston Polytechnic, as it was called then, and I met the most wonderful chemistry teacher. And he was a retired boxer with a really squashed in face. And he watched me doing this practical in this first week, and he came over to me and he said, "What are you doing here?" He said, "Because you don't know what you're up to here, do you?" And I said, "No, I've no idea." And he said, "Well, why are you here?" And I said, "I've got to get into medical school. And I've got to get chemistry A level, and I've got to get a B or an A." And anyway, he just took me on as a challenge. And I think it was a combination of being an ex-boxer who decided to go into teaching late in life. And he also looked like my dad, who was an enormously wonderful mentor to me too. So I think the combination of my dad at home encouraging me and Mr. Mercer at Kingston Poly, I got into the Royal Free Medical School. And when I got in, it wasn't difficult. It really wasn't difficult. It was
what
just
happened to the physics?
Oh, I never did do physics, and I never did manage to get physics. And I think it was also, never got physics, no. But it's very funny because I now have a daughter who's gone into medicine as a medical student late in life. She's 31 now, and her big problem was chemistry. When she had to go back to school in her middle 20s, having been an art historian for some years, and she had to go back to school, and chemistry was the stumbling block. So it's like mother, like daughter. We've got a block about chemistry.
Well, chemistry is meant to be the hardest A level. I don't know whether you know that, but it is. It's apparently as difficult as Sanskrit. So it's it is. Perhaps you should have done that if you were good at languages. Anyway, let's have a romp through your early career, because I really want to spend some time talking about your current role as Women's Health Ambassador. So edited highlights, if I may.
Highlights. Well, it wasn't a choice of going into obs and gynae because I had another wonderful mentor, amazing woman called Luba Epstein, who was a middle European Jewish lady who'd been refugeed several times. And she used to pick two or three of us every year at the Royal Free Medical School and say, you are going to become an obstetrician and gynecologist. And that was that. And I was one of her pets in fact, one of her last years when she did that. And so it was really sort of a done deal. I was going to do obs and gynae and it was fantastic. And I followed her advice and she became a sort of a surrogate mum to me for many years. And she was just very, very good at championing people and making sure that they were okay. So that was good. And then I had another lucky break, I think. I've had a lot of lucky breaks as well. I had a big sort of fallout with a very, very sort of autocratic clinician at the old Chelsea Hospital for Women, which is where if you wanted to do obs and gynae, you needed to try and get some time in there. And they wanted me to go and apply for a job where I knew I'd be very unhappy because it was an unhappy place. And, you know, it was an uncomfortable situation where this guy said to me, well, you know, if you don't do what I'm going to tell you to do, then I'm going to make sure you don't work in London again. And I was terribly upset about that, I remember, and thought how unfair it all was. And then another consultant at the hospital sort of rang me up and said, look, I've heard there's been a bit of a problem and I want you to come and see me. Come and see me in my rooms tomorrow. So that meant going down to see me in Harley Street. And then as I went in, he passed me a copy of the BMJ, you know, with all the adverts in the back. And he just circled round one. He says, I want you to go and apply for this job. He says, I've made the phone calls. And then I went up to Cambridge and he said, just go for a year. And he said, it'll all calm down and then it'll all be fine again. And I went
A bit easier to do that in those days. It wouldn't be allowed now.
And I went up to Cambridge, never been to Cambridge before, you know, got through the interview, got the job and went up to Cambridge and I was going to stay for a year, but I stayed for 8 years. And that was the most, I think that was the best time in terms of training because there was so much work to do and enormous population. Large population. There was only one maternity and one gynecology unit in that area, really. And it just in at the deep end. But when I left 8 years later and came back to London to my first consultant role, there was just nothing I didn't feel I couldn't tackle. I wouldn't say that I was expert at everything, but you could, you know, I just felt very, very confident that whatever was thrown up, I'd be able to start it. And also I'd had a boss up there who was really good at instilling me with the belief that asking for help is a strength, not a weakness. And I think that's probably one of the most useful things I ever learned. And I think it's probably one of the most useful things I pass on to everybody else. It's really a strength to ask for help. Even if you think you know what the answer is. I mean, for example, I've got a little rule, a self-imposed rule, that if I remember ever looking after someone who's a friend or somehow closer to me than a patient relationship, I like to bounce it off another person. I mean, I don't mean ring them up there and then, but we'll say to a colleague a few days later, how do you think? Do you think I've missed something with this? And I think it's really, really helps. And I found subsequently when I was doing leadership roles at the RCOG, when I was vice president and president, and I had to start traveling to visit units that were traumatized or had problems, it was all because people didn't realise that talking through a problem was often a really, really good way to communicate and to make sure that things didn't go wrong or weren't overlooked. So I've always thought that was really helpful. And I learned that in Cambridge.
So I'm gonna hurry you along. So you then went back to London.
Yeah, went back to London. And I got married at that point and I inherited 4 stepchildren. So I realised after a while that I couldn't carry on commuting from Cambridge. I'd have to get a job. So I applied for the first job that came up, which was a senior lecturer post. I had no intention of becoming an academic, but I took the job and I thought, well, I'll do this for a couple of years and then I'll go and apply for, you know, another job. But I got totally sucked in by the excitement of Getting that grant, you know, 9 refused and then the last one you got. And then the thing that really persuaded me to stay in the world of academia for a while anyway was the exhilaration of having research fellows who did well. And I remember going along to a meeting in about sort of 1995, something like that, and I've been a senior lecturer for a few years, and I saw 2 of my research fellows getting prizes, and I mean, honestly, I just felt the bee's knees. I just thought it was so fabulous to see them succeeding and getting their thesis and their MD or their PhD, and I thought, well, I really like this, and I felt that it's like the highs outweighed the awful lows, and there were so many far more lows than there were highs, but I still found it quite captivating, that.
So what area was your research?
So I was looking into the causes of repeated miscarriages, and at that time there was a lot of theories going on about how it must be to do with a disordered immune system, and how the fetus has 50% of its, you know, its genetic message or identifiers as the paternal side, and why weren't they rejected? And my MD thesis basically poo-pooed the idea of the time. And that was another very important learning curve for me, because I wasn't supporting the theory, and because my trial showed that it was absolutely no difference if you randomised the patients properly and had a control group, it was very, very difficult to publish the papers on it. And I thought that was a really interesting thing. And it also fueled me up to think that in the future, it's really important to give weight to negative findings, because if nothing else, they stop you wasting any more resource doing that, and you can move on to other things. But that was quite an important learning curve for me as well.
So, go on.
And then applying for the role as a professor when my predecessor, Richard Beard, retired, I applied for the role, and I'd been at Imperial for 5 or 6 years then, and they kept telling me about how Imperial was, really good too. They had no problems with gender and something other. It was an absolute nightmare. I mean, the principal at the time, I shall leave him nameless, basically said to me, "Well, you're too young. You haven't got £5 million worth of grant money," which in 1996 was an impossible target, in a surgical specialty, and you're a woman. And he actually said it to me. You're a woman, you're no use.
Yeah.
And I just think about, my God, if I said that to somebody now, I think I'd be struck off, and probably rightly so. But anyway. Well,
some people would have seen that as an insurmountable barrier, but not you.
No, well, I mean, I remember getting out of the interview with him, the pre-interview, and going down to my car and bursting into tears, because I just thought, I can't believe that I've let that person say that to me. And I kept thinking how stupid I was. I should have made some fuss or other. But all he did when he turned around, and he said all this looking out of a window with his back to me, and he turned around, he said, "Oh, you're still here." And I sat down because I was so shocked by what he said. I just sat down and I said, "Well, yes, of course I'm here, because I've got an appointment to talk to you."
Yeah, well done. Well done, you. A bit of showing a bit of grit at that stage. Yeah, anyway. So again, I'm sorry to be rushing you through, but that wasn't the end of it all, was it?
No. And then and I went through various things, and I tried to get into, I tried to start doing some things that were a bit more sort of less niche and more general for women's health. But the light bulb moment, I think, for me was going to a lecture, which again was serendipity. I hadn't meant to be there. I heard Michael Marmot talking in 2010, just as he published his report, Fair Society, Healthy Lives. And I was so struck by what he said. I suppose, as an obstetrician and gynecologist, that disadvantage starts before birth and it accumulates throughout life. And that was so pertinent to so many things that I saw were wrong. But the thing that really struck the chord was when he was talking about the fact that the healthcare I'd been trained to deliver was only ever going to solve a third of the problem, and the other two thirds were all the social determinants of disease. And I started looking at all the things that were wrong with women's healthcare, I mean, and really, Jane, we know we're talking about that now, and I'm coming up to my ambassador role. But then, you know, people thought, what are you talking about? You know, because what's wrong with, you know, what is women's healthcare? And I realised that I couldn't get anyone at Imperial to sort of change their views about how we delivered things and make it very easy for women to get help with their periods, you know, terribly common problem periods. I mean, there's nothing else that happens to human beings 12 times a year for 40 years of their lives. And a lot of women are totally disabled by them, and girls can't go to school. And, you know, if you allowed, or rather, if I could empower all the girls and women in this country to decide if and when and with whom and how many times they became pregnant, you know, we would really change the outlook for women's health dramatically. And I wanted to also change the focus because most of us women nowadays are only pregnant for a couple of years of our lives. And you and I are likely to live into our 80s now. So that means there's another 80 bit and a bit years to be cared for. And when I left medical school back in 1980, women disappeared from view at 50 because they were no longer reproductive. So that's really a nutshell of what I've been trying to do as the ambassador, because Fantastic. It's actually resetting the dial and saying, look, most of the times when women go to healthcare professionals, they're not actually ill. They're trying to do maintenance things to maintain their health and also maintain their role in society, whether it's as a mother of children or a carer of older people or contributing to the economy. And remember as well that the NHS, the largest employer in Europe, is 80% women now. So it really, really matters that we get women's maintenance stuff easy. And so fast forward, because I couldn't get all this sorted out at Imperial, I thought I need a national role. So I applied to be vice president at the college. And then I thought, right, well, being vice president isn't enough because I can't really change things. And so I became the president of the college. I found that really helpful because I met all sorts of other people who were trying to do similar sorts of things in their own specialty. For example, I met you, I met Claire Marks, I met all sorts of people in that grouping at the Academy of Medical Royal Colleges, which all the presidents went to on a regular basis. And then I wrote a document just at the end of my tenure, which was called Better for Women. And it was a policy document, basically picking apart what was wrong with what I thought the way we were delivering women's healthcare and how it was still focused around disease intervention. And the thesis of this report was, which was called Better for Women, although we could have said called it Better for Women, Better for Everyone, and Better for Less, because you can do it for less money if you do it properly. But most of it was predicated on the fact that you can predict almost everything that you're going to need as a woman for the maintenance stuff that I'm talking about, and that we to not predict it and be there to ensure that you spend very little time getting access to what you need for your painful heavy periods or your abnormal smear or your troublesome menopause is madness. And then I think, I rather cockily think that I left that job in December 2019. We published the report and I thought I was going to spend the next few years of my life cruising into retirement and implementing the other recommendations from that report. And then, of course, COVID struck and everyone was paralyzed for a year or so. And I couldn't harass people at the Department of Health to actually get a women's health strategy. But the number one recommendation for that report is we must have an NHS-led women's health strategy. So fast forward, 2021, International Women's Day, the Department of Health launched this public consultation on women's health. They said that they were going to publish it in the outcome in 3 or 4 months. And of course, it took 18 months to come out. Reason? They had 100,000 responses and they've never, no government department's ever had so many responses. And almost all women complaining about what they was wrong with the service. And it was just like writing the Better for Women report all over this thing. The next year in 2022, they announced the fact that I was going to become the NHS Women's Health Department of Health Women's Health Ambassador. Somebody had sort of stuck this job description under my nose, and I thought, well, I can't let this opportunity go by, because there's never been a government that has said we're going to prioritise women's health. So I thought I have to use this opportunity. And that's one of my mantras, Jane, that I've always said that opportunities very rarely make appointments. And if you don't grab them, then you miss them. And yeah, I would really regret that if I'd missed it.
I quote you often on that one. And I'm going to put in a little plug for you. I am going to mention that you were interviewed by one Boris Johnson for the role.
Well, I'm not going to.
Something. He did something. He did some good things.
He did some good things, yes. And he was absolutely extraordinary. That's what I say. I mean, and I remember going in thinking, oh dear, what's going to happen here? And coming out having been completely charmed by him. He was extraordinarily charming when he was talking to people. So there we go.
That's another story, as they say. So let's get back. So you're now the Women's Health Ambassador.
Yeah.
Tell us all about that.
Well, I think, Jane, you got a bit of experience of working with the Department of Health and with NHS England at the senior level. And it is a bit frustration because I think you and I are a little bit similar there because I think we're both relatively impatient people. And we like results and not faffing around. So it is a bit frustrating. And I have been known to say things like, my God, the scale of progress here makes a garden snail look like a Ferrari, and things like that. But I mustn't dwell on that. And I have to say, and I want to give a plug for the team I'm working with. There's a Women's Health Strategy team in the Department of Health, and they have been marvellous, absolutely marvellous. I was a bit of a sort of a shock for them when I came into the post because I think they were expecting me to be sort of very sort of, oh, yes, OK, fine. If that's what you want me to do, that's what we'll do. And of course, I've got all sorts of ideas about how we should be doing it differently. But they've been really, really good. And we've got a bit of a modus vivendi now in the sense that sometimes I think that what we've got to do is just do it and ask for forgiveness later. And I think that's paid off a couple of times. And one of the things that I think now has become almost like public ownership, which is really good, and that is this concept of women's health hubs. So not necessarily a place-based hub, it can be a virtual hub, but the concept is that we've got to be able to allow Jane Dacre to come to a place where she can get her smear and her menopause or her period problems or her contraception or her irritable bladder sorted out, because she's got to be able to get on with the rest of her life. And rather than send you round five different places, all of which, and four of them are going to say, well, we can't do that here, we want you to go to one place. So I think how the models will work was that you'll have a sophisticated virtual triage with very senior people in it, working out where you need to be sent to. So, for example, you know, if you needed a prescription for something, I probably don't need to make you get on a bus or a train or, you know, go to an appointment. I could send your pharmacy a prescription. But if you needed something else and we needed some diagnostics, then you might need to go to another type of hub where they could do that. But for example, if you came to me with postmenopausal bleeding, there is no point me sending you to a gynecology clinic and doing scans and things like that, because we know that the gold standard is I've got to sample your endometrium or your womb lining. So why not just send you straight to the procedure hub? We know, obviously, we explain to you and consent you and point you to some good information on the website. And so all of these things have required work to get them up to scratch. So the Women's Health Hub.
Are they up and running?
They're coming through now. So we managed to get £25 million, which was in some ways a drop in the ocean, but it's better than nothing. And it was a token to say to people that we were. And of course, the announcement came out on International Women's Day 2023. It's a great day, International Women's Day, for good news, I think. And so we've divided that between the 42 integrated care boards. And of course, it's not a lot. But it means that everyone's got the opportunity to. And we decided as well to divide it between the 42 rather than do it by head of population. Because what I'm finding when I go around the country to visit these ICBs, and I've been to them all now, is that the bigger ones and the ones that are able to, that are more affluent, if you like, are able to do things. And so the ones that have got a lot of disadvantage in them end up slipping further and further below. So I wanted, even if you came, you know, even if you were, your hub was going to be in a coastal deprived area, that you had an opportunity to set something up for the women that you needed. And also, I wanted very much to make sure it wasn't one size fits all, that it wasn't going to be another diktat. You've got to do this. So we've given them the materials and said, look, what does your population need? I've been really impressed. I think one of the things that I would say, even when I'm having a gloomy week or thinking, oh my God, when are we ever going to get something over the line? I've never had a job before in my 44 years as a doctor where every time I talk about something, someone gets up, figuratively or virtually or literally, and says, can I do something to help? And they always say, I don't want to be paid for it. Can I do something to help?
Fantastic.
And I think that's really lovely, because it makes me feel that it really is worth doing, and that it's the really important bit of advocacy. And advocacy, I think, is persuading people, changing hearts and minds and persuading people to think differently.
So do you have a view on how you're going to measure the outcomes? How are you going to know whether this is working, or do you know if it's working yet?
Well, yes, because there are some hubs that have been up and running for a while, run by some very, very inspiring leaders, and several of them, I'll spare their blushes, but several of them have been run in a way that they can count as a metric as how few women need to be referred into secondary care. So, of course, you know, the biggest ticket on NHS England and the DH's worry book at the moment is the increasing waiting lists for secondary care, outpatients and inpatient care. So my argument is at the moment, and that's why I'm hoping I'm going to get more money to scale up these hubs, is that I'm not saying that it's going to replace gynaecology outpatients, but gynaecology outpatients needs to be reserved for women who have more complex problems that the hubs have tried to resolve and we've not been able to discharge them back to get on with their lives. They've obviously got other things that we need to resolve. So I've got this list that I'm always quoting to everyone. You know, women should not need to go to secondary care for any form of contraception, even complex, or period problems, or menopause management, or, you know, problems, for example, with bladder problems initially. They should be able to get those sorted out in a women's health hub and get on. If the treatment doesn't, you know, if, for example, you came to me with painful heavy periods and I fitted you with a Mirena coil and after 3 to 6 months trial of that it didn't work, okay, then you need more additional specialist help. So then I need to send you to a specialist unit. But most of the women are going to be able to go away from the hub with things relatively sorted out. And I would say smears and colposcopy as well. You don't need to go to a hospital for that. You can easily have it done in a hub. And I think it will be marvellous, because women don't want to take 5 days off work to do what they could do in one morning or one day. And the other thing I want is to introduce as well, but let's get the hubs up and running a bit more first, is patient-initiated follow-up. And when I've said that in the past, people have said to me, oh, we can't do that, we'll be overrun. And to which I say, you must be joking. You know, none of the women with the problems that I'm describing to you, which are part of their maintenance health, are going to want to come and clutter up your outpatient clinic for for an appointment they don't need.
Yeah.
If you tell them that they can contact you or the team if there is a complication later, they'll say thanks very much and, you know,
be really interesting. Yeah. There's so many specialties where that could work and work really well. I think we're too paternalistic, aren't we?
Paternalistic.
Can I we're coming to the end of the time in a minute, but we haven't talked about maternity. Now, maternity is a real problem, with all sorts of scandals and difficulties, and maternal mortality and infant mortality being quite an issue. Is that part of your role, or is that something different?
Well, strictly speaking, it's not in my remit, but I've argued, and I'm delighted that the new Secretary of State thinks the same way, is that actually maternity is a small snapshot within the woman's reproductive life course. And I think if we spent a lot more time ensuring that she had the information, the woman has enough information to try to ensure that she's in the best possible health before she embarks on a pregnancy. And if that wasn't possible, then she has the information she needs to make sure that the second pregnancy has a better outcome. And post-birth contraception plays a crucial role in that, but no one in maternity will take it on. But I'm going to make them take it on because it has to happen. And it's the one way we're going to really improve outcomes. And then after those maternities are over, of course, we know that the way that a woman behaves during pregnancy physiologically can frequently signpost us to the problems that she may have later. So if you developed a bit of preeclampsia or high blood pressure when you were pregnant with your children, Jane, the chances of you having cardiovascular disease 10 years earlier than your next door neighbour who didn't have hypertension is very significant. And going back to my old thing, in my miscarriage patients, the ones who've got prothrombotic problems causing them to miscarry, we know that they're going to get cardiovascular disease earlier than the women who didn't have miscarriages. And perhaps the most important thing we could contribute there is that one in five women get a degree of depression either during pregnancy or the year afterwards. And that is almost pathognomonic of them needing mental health services later. So rather than saying at the postnatal visit, oh, is the baby vaccinated and this, that and the other, all of which is important, I think we should use that postnatal visit to really think about what this woman's going to need in the future. And once again, get upstream and prevent those problems happening.
Fantastic. That's all really interesting, absolutely fascinating. And it's incredible to hear your passion. Now, some of the women or some of the people that are listening to this podcast might want to be inspired by something specific, some piece of advice that you might want to give them. What would you say to people coming up?
I would first of all, that opportunities rarely make appointments, but I've already said that. The other thing I would say, and I think it's been most true in the last 5 to 10 years, when I've been in I suppose more senior leadership roles, is that I'm now absolutely convinced that you can travel so much farther and so much faster in life if you stop fussing about who gets the credit. And if you work with people and you're constantly saying to them, goodness, that was great, well done you, everybody feels better. And things just get done more quickly. So I think it's really important to stop worrying about the credit. And the last thing I'd like to say is that the reason why I think it's so important to empower women to know what they need to do about their health and their maintenance health is because the thing about women is that when you tell them or offer them advice as to what they can best do, not only do they usually do it, but then they go and tell everybody else about it too. They tell their daughter, they tell their daughter-in-law, they tell their mum, their sister, the next door lady, the cleaning lady, you know, everybody, they talk about it. So women are fantastic amplifiers. And that's just, I think it just goes on the second X chromosome, but they really do amplify messages, good and bad ones. So I think it's really important that we give them the tools they need. So I think that the job we've got to do is to move from that patriarchal thing about doing things to women to actually saying, here, this is what you need. Now, you know, this is what you need to go and do the best for your health. And that, of course, I think will pass through generations.
And telling people about it, that's fantastic. It'll make an incredible difference to women. Well, Leslie, it's been wonderful talking to you. And I think you'll inspire not only women doctors, but also the women that are listening to what you might have to say. So thank you very much for talking to me today.
Well, thank you, Jane. And thank you for running this podcast. And it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
You've been listening to Medical Women Talking with me, Jane Dacre. If you wish to hear more conversations with medical women, then check out the other seasons of this podcast series. And thank you for listening.